But I just want to make a point about belief in a higher authority. Something I didn't stress when I spoke about it is that there is also a way of knowing where we are revealed divinely some piece of knowledge. So, you know, I sort of more stress that which we accept because our teachers teach us that. And we maybe accept that on the grounds that we realize that they have undergone this kind of process, and so that gives us some confidence in it. But we wouldn't be dealing completely with epistemology if we didn't acknowledge that there is also divine revelation. And I actually think that that's really how a person gets to know about origins. Personally, I think so. I don't know whether reasoning with someone is in fact going to convince them one way or the other to the extent they'll change their mind. I might be wrong. But I think that it is primarily a spiritual issue. And it, you know, God convicts you and speaks to your conscience and stuff like that. And but that said, I do think that it's very important for us to be able to give an account for what we believe and to be able to reason intellectually. And maybe there is also the chance that perhaps through reasoning intellectually we might be able to persuade someone. But let's now get on to the actual data that we can start making some kind of judgments about. Remember, we spoke about the difference between data and inference, and it's very important to distinguish between them. Data is what you can actually observe. Inference is the pattern that you get from that, the sense that you make from that. Now, this is a list of some of the data or arguments that is used by each of these, you know, proponents of these theories. And let's take each of them in turn. So an evolutionist would probably back up his claim that life evolved by referring to mutations, recombination, homology, dating, and natural selection. You've got some more perhaps later you can raise them. Whereas a proponent of intelligent design would point to information design and reducible complexity, lack of transitional forms and fossil, and also to natural selection. It's common to the two. So let's start off with natural selection. Remember that when we were looking at epistemology, in the realm of science, some things you can observe today, and you can actually do experiments on them today, and that kind of knowledge is quite strong because it's repeatable by peers. Natural selection falls into this category. So we can make strong claims about natural selection. Now, this is actually the theory which led Darwin to propose evolution in the first place. His book is called The Origin of Species by Natural Selection. We normally just say The Origin of Species. So what is natural selection? Now, to make you understand it, you know, people have varying amounts of biological knowledge here. And, you know, that makes it a little difficult to work with because there's such a range. But it's really very simple, so I'd like you to kind of figure it out yourself in a way by turning to page 24. 24, and you see question 2. It says there are changes in peppered moths. Alright, I'll just give you the background, and then I'll explain to you how you're going to answer this question. This here is the most well-known example used to illustrate what natural selection is all about. And what happened was that in England, before the Industrial Revolution, the trees were covered with lichen. Here's lichen. Lichen, it's actually a symbiotic relationship between fungi and algae, and it grows on trees, and it looks sort of whitish, pale greenish. And so the pre-industrial revolution trees were covered with lichen, and also those furthest from the factory were covered with lichen and so pale in color. Then as factories produced soot, these trees became covered with soot, and so they became dark in color. Now there's a certain kind of moth, species of moth called the peppered moth. The peppered moth has a variety of kinds of moths, some being mainly white with black spots and others being black with white spots. They can interbreed with one another though. They're part of the same species. Right, so what happened with the peppered moths? I want you to piece that out because it really is logical. You can work it out yourself. Look on page 24, question 2. The way it works is, in each of those lines, where there's an option, you must choose which option makes the most sense. So for the first one, there's no option, it just tells you. There are two colors of peppered moths, dark and light. These moths sometimes rest on the trunks of trees that are eaten by birds. Then for 2.2, it says on lichen-covered trees, and you must choose which one is the most logical, A or B. You just circle either A or B. And so you go on to make up the whole argument. Right, now we need to understand the genetics behind this. Mendel's laws were not yet known at that time. Now we understand a lot about genetics, a lot about DNA. Now what basically is happening, very simplified, is that here you have, I'm using a cross for the white gene and thing for the black gene, I mean, it doesn't matter. You have a population, let me first define the words species and population. Species and population. Now, all of these definitions you can find in the back of the book. There is a glossary there. And the word species means a group of organisms which could reproduce with one another, interbreed, if they were given the chance to. So you have the lion species. And lions in Kruger National Park, and in a zoo in India, they belong to the same species because they could interbreed with one another were they brought together. The word population is a subgroup of species. It is a group, members of the same species, which can practically interbreed with one another because they live in the same area as one another. So a lion in Kruger National Park and in a zoo in India, they're not part of the same population because they can't get one another to breed with one another. Even though theoretically, I mean, they've got the genes that are compatible. Alright, so we have a population here of a certain species of moths. And we've got, within that population, we have white genes, black genes, whatever. Right, and we have another adjacent population with just the same. And now we change the conditions. Over here we have lichen, and here we have soot. And what's happening is that in the lichen-covered trees, we're getting the black genes being knocked off by the birds. Maybe that one who owned those genes was eaten, doesn't get a chance to reproduce, doesn't pass on his genes to the next generation. Whereas this one survives, and so the next generation also has a white gene. Obviously, this is very simplistic because it looks like, yeah, it's, just the moth giving birth to without any other parent, but, you know, we're just being simplistic here. Maybe this one actually does survive somehow or other, so we still do have some black moths. Right, that one survives, and that one doesn't. Maybe that one also doesn't, because I mean, some of them don't. So that's in the next generation. What has happened? Yeah, we've had a change in the population, in that, first of all, the population had a certain ratio of black and white genes, and now it has a different ratio. But can you see that change has come about not by the addition of any genetic information at all, rather by the loss of some? And then, of course, here in the soot one, we have something else, you know, where these ones are more likely to survive. And some of those will, but not so much. So we have a different ratio there. Now, let's imagine that instead of this being lichen and soot and moths and stuff, let's imagine that all of this here was part of a single population of whatever animal you like. And
some of them just happen to be more active during the day, and others tend to be more active at night. So more diurnal and nocturnal. Maybe the crosses represent diurnal and the circles are nocturnal. Alright, then. Perhaps then this area gets covered, gets split in half by a river. So the river now flows, separating what used to be one population, they could interbreed with one another, into two populations, and now they can't get at one another to interbreed. They're isolated. Perhaps on one side of the river, you have predators that are more active in the day. Then those parts of that population, that we now prey, that are more active during the day are less likely to survive, and those active at night are more likely to survive. Maybe on the other side of the river, it's the other way around. So that we also get this change, because of natural selection, survival of the fittest, but because what is fittest is different on either side of the river. On one side of the river, we get this organism mainly being active at night, and the other in the day. Now, the river goes away, dries up. And these two can now interbreed with one another. They're now again part of the same population. But they won't interbreed with one another because they're not active at the same time of day, so they don't get at one another. So what's actually happened then is that you've split, according to the definition of species, you've split that population into two different species. Speciation has occurred. Now, this was used by early debaters of evolution to make fools of early debaters of creation. Because initially, many people understood the word species to mean what God created, a created kind. And according to that, you would say you can get variation within a species but not across a species. You can't make new species. That would then be defying God's law that says reproduce after your kind, not across your kind. Alright, so when they would debate, the creationists would say, yes, you can get variation, but not across a species. Meaning, not across what God created. The evolutionists would then point to the scenario I've just described and say, and there is data for that. There's data given in the book. Where it actually has been observed that you do get speciation. Namely, that you get splitting where they afterwards will not be able to reproduce one another if you define the word species, not as what God created, but whether they can reproduce one another or not. Now, do you notice that this is an example of equivocation? Because they're using the word species, the two parties that are debating, they're each meaning something different. And so, evolutionists were using that equivocation to prove the creationists wrong. But even if the change in brought about by natural selection actually causes speciation, still do you see that there's no introduction of information happening here? And so it's really not valuable at all for an evolutionist. What can I do with the presenter now? Put it down somewhere? Probably the same place that I put
my book. On the table.
On the table, okay. All right, thanks. Good, so, speciation is just a subset of microevolution. And it's really not helpful at all in deciding whether evolution or intelligent design is the more reasonable option, because it's compatible with both. But for evolution to be the only one that's reasonable, we'd need to be able to demonstrate that an increase of information is possible. And that must be so enough just for an increase of information to be possible. That increase of information has actually caused major changes in structure and function. So the point I'm trying to get across here is that natural selection is observable, and it's not been observed many times, so is speciation, but it's not relevant to the debate, because it's equivalent to both. Right, so, evolutionists have this problem that they have to have some mechanism to introduce new information. So where does that new information come from? Not from natural selection. Natural selection cannot do that. It can only allow that which is already available to be selected or rejected. Like that. Survival of the fittest. Of what's already there. So they have two solutions that they propose for how information is introduced. Mutations and recombination. So let's look at each of these. Mutation means a change to the genetic structure. Again, this is something we can actually experiment on. So we can get quite strong knowledge about this. There are two kinds of mutation, chromosomal and point. So mutation is like a mistake in the DNA. And this can happen either for large sections of genes or for one point inside the DNA structure. Let's start with chromosomal mutation. When you hear on the radio people saying the TB bacterium has mutated and developed resistance to a certain drug, they might be referring to natural selection, which I just explained just now, which is just simply that before we had a lot of TB bacteria, some resistant, some not, and they were mostly those that were not, the drug worked killing them all. But now there are many that are resistant, so the drug doesn't work, which is not adding information whatsoever. And I don't really see how they can call that mutation. But usually, what they're referring to when they say that is a chromosomal mutation. This here is a representation of a piece of DNA, actually a piece of a gene. And each of those letters refers to a nucleotide. Those with no biology will know what I mean by that. Alright, now, during chromosomal mutation, a group of nucleotides are changed in some way. They might be translocated, they might be moved from one side, one part to another. Actually, that would be an entire gene, moved from one chromosome to another. That's not adding information. Information was there before, and it's just moved to another place. Deletion, it might just be gone. That's certainly not adding information. Duplication just might be reproducing, well, you know, making another one of itself. It's also not adding information, it's just making more of the same. And inversion, meaning flipping around. That's the one that usually they're referring to when they say this bacterium mutated to develop resistance. Why? You see, when the gene is this way around, perhaps it does work. You see, what happens is genes are like the instructions of what proteins should be made in the body, and then proteins of determine what happens in the body, functions of the body. So, when this gene is this way around, this particular gene here is on. So it will be translated into a protein. So maybe this is a gene for making a certain protein which protects the bacterium from a certain drug. When in this position, then it's making that protein so it'll be protected from that drug. Now, there might be some other negative consequences of making that protein. So that gene might actually be flipped around to switch it off so that it no longer makes that drug, that protein. That bacteria would then be susceptible to that drug. Then, if that drug is now available, then the bacteria might actually flip that gene back around to make that protein again. And so then it looks like it's got the ability to make the protein which it didn't have before. It appears that information's been added that wasn't there before, the ability to make this protein. But notice that's not so. The ability was there before, just switched off, and now it's switched on. So chromosomal mutations are of no use to the evolutionists to explain where this extra information comes from. What they point to is mutations. That's what they're hoping for. And a point mutation is a mistake, a breaking of the DNA strand at a particular point, usually caused by radiation, gamma rays or microwaves or just the rays of the sun. We have, all of us, a lot of mutations in our body. Fortunately, they're always masked, they often usually masked by an allergen. Otherwise, we'd be wrecks. Now, I didn't want to overwhelm you with lots of horrible pictures because you've already seen enough. So, no, that's an excuse. I wanted to download some pictures of mutations and Activity Connect. So I don't have any pictures for you of mutations, but they're all dreadful. I mean, mutations cause damage. So you might have a child being born without an eye, without a knob, or with six fingers, or even just being susceptible to certain diseases, or having a certain disease. Those are mutations. Mutations cause harm. Let me say it again. The mutations that we have observed, they either, and most of them, cause harm, or else they don't seem to make any difference. So like, for example, albinism is a mutation that causes your skin not to have the pigment melanin, and so then you're very white. Now that's harmful because then you're more susceptible to the sun. But maybe like in the context of a lion in a zoo, albinism is, it's not harmful. It's maybe even is quite nice and sweet, you know. In the wild, that lion would be less camouflaged. So, you know, in certain contexts, maybe you could say the mutation might not be harmful. Like perhaps if you have a very windy island, and then you have a mutation in a certain flying insect that stops it having wings. Well, maybe you couldn't fly on that island anyway because there's so much wind. So you could say, oh, it's not harmful to you. But it's still a loss of information. So, you see, it's not actually from what we've observed. From what we've observed about mutations, they're not helpful to evolution. However, it's like Peter said, you can't, you know, prove a universal negative. That doesn't mean to say that given lots and lots of time, maybe you would get a mutation that was actually adding information. It's never been observed at all. But that doesn't mean it can't happen. Maybe it could. Now, Richard Dawkins was asked about this. Actually, it's worse than what was shown here, because he in fact said, after all, no, put off the camera. And then he put off the camera, and then, you know, just had a bit of a chance. And then he continued. And what he answers now is completely, I think, off the topic. He then goes on, he says, well, there's a misunderstanding of what evolution is. We're not saying that modern fish turned into modern mammals. No, it was a prehistoric fish that turned into a prehistoric mammal. And then, if we'd been present, then we would have seen a mutation, which was beneficial. So, he's not answering the question, which is there any mutation that's been observed that is beneficial? Well, he is, by omission. You can't give one. Okay. Right. So can you see that we can't disprove evolution in this way? But it throws a lot of doubt on it. All right, then it's recombination. The other way that evolution suggests that maybe this information got added. Now, there are two kinds of recombination. I'd like you to turn to page 33. And you see there's a little table there. It's a very simple little exercise. It's more really just to help you to concentrate what I'm saying, so that you make a judgment about it rather than me just give it to you on a platter. See page 33, question 2. It says recombination during meiosis and injection of viral DNA into bacteria. Those are the two kinds of recombination you can get. And then you are asked to judge whether each of these causes an increase of information in the species, and secondly, does it increase information in the biosphere in the world as a whole. So I'm going to explain what these mean, and then I want you to make a judgment about that. Right, meiosis is a process of cell division that occurs in reproductive cells. It's actually the halving, it involves the halving of the number of chromosomes in preparation for fertilization to counteract the doubling effect of fertilization. If you don't have biological knowledge, don't worry too much. But what happens is that you have the chromosomes lying together, and then this and this one would have come maybe from your father and that one from your mother. Now they must get separated from one another, and only one of them will go to your child, if at all. And what happens is that they cross over and then they pull apart with some information from the other. And this causes more variation. So that even if your child gets this one, they won't look only like your father. They'll look a bit like your mother. And of course, the partner is also involved. So this just causes more variation. Otherwise, children would always look very much, would look the same as their parents, or very much like their parents. And all children in a certain family would look the same as one another. All right, so that's meiotic combination, recombination. Next one is recombination by viral insertion into bacteria. Here you've got a virus. It has DNA in it with certain instructions. And it has been observed that viruses can inject that DNA into a bacterium, and that DNA then gets incorporated into the plasmid of the DNA of the bacterium, into the DNA ring of the bacterium, and immediately can be expressed, as in it makes proteins coded for it. Now, even though that happens, bacteria have never been observed to change into anything other than bacterium, despite the fact that they are getting DNA added in this way. So it still is not macroevolution, because although information is being added to the bacterium, it's not causing a major structural or functional change. So it's still not macroevolution. So just quickly then decide whether each of these adds information to the individual organism and to the biosphere as a whole. So you can just choose yes or no in each case. Okay, do people want to make some comments? What do you say? Does this add, does meiosis add information to the organism?
No.
Not at all. I mean, it's just rearranging what's present there. Does it add it to the biosphere? If it doesn't add it to the organism, it can't add it to the biosphere. Right, that's just a simple rearrangement. What about insertion by viruses? Yeah. Does that add information to the bacterium which is receiving it?
Yes.
Yes. Does it add it to the biosphere, to the universe, the world as a whole? No, it doesn't. Because, you know, it was present in the virus and it just moved. So this is really, I suppose, well, I think they rather refer to mutations as the bigger host. But, you know, even where there is some addition into an organism, it's not adding it to the virus, it's not really helping to evolution. Okay. So now we've moved away from, or we've come to the end of the data that we can look at by experiments. The next category of data, and I'll stop very quickly, I know that the time is just about done, but I might as well get as far as I can, and then we'll continue tomorrow, is data where we just see like the footprints left behind by the event, and we must use our reasoning to try and make some sense to it. And it's, you know, you've got to be very careful because worldview plays a huge role. Let's get on to information. Right, now, that movie we watched on the first night spoke quite a lot about this, so I'm going to repeat some of the stats. There is an incredible amount of information in the universe. Just in one pinhead of DNA. You have enough information there, as you heard in the movie, to translate it into words and put it into words. It would make a stack of books extending from the surface of the earth to the moon 500 times. Yes. And that's just in one pinhead.
Yeah.
Now, all of that had to come from somewhere. The only source that we know of that can produce information is intelligence. You know, if we see a book, we really will not ever think that anything other than a human author wrote it. Because, you know, it needs intelligence. intelligence here, by the way, doesn't necessarily mean like having an IQ of a certain amount. It just means being able to make decisions rather than being just subject to random processes. Now, how on earth did all of this come about? As a creationist, the answer, of course, would be an intelligent being would make it, and that's not at all inconsistent or inconceivable because intelligent beings do that. But what about an evolutionist? What do they have to offer as an explanation? Their only answer can be, as far as I see, that random processes of molecules bumping together would be just right to put them in a sequence that would appear as if it were intelligent. I've got a friend who's a landscape architect. She's got a big screen, a touch screen, which she uses to create the designs. And the other day on Facebook, she posted, she said, now there's so many insects that are being drawn to the screen, and then they hit against the screen, and now, of course, they touch it. So I answered back, I said, well, you just need to train these things, right, so that they do your designs for you, and then you can sit back. By our time, when we observe insects hitting against the screen, of course we're never going to see a nice garden design made. So we're only watching for, I wouldn't be able to watch for very long. I think 5 minutes would be far too long. But you know, even if you watch for 50 years, that's still very short. But given millions of years, it could happen. And you can't prove that it, couldn't. It seems extremely unlikely, but you can't really prove that it wouldn't. So you see, again, we've got to the point where we cannot prove, but it looks to me that intelligent design is far more reasonable than evolution. Okay, let's just skip this and then I'll stop. This is time to statisticians have calculated the probability of life forming in this way, and they say that it's 1 in 10 to the power, 100,000 million, million, which is the same as one person winning the national lottery every week for 10,000 million years. So you decide whether you'd like to take your faith in that. We'll continue tomorrow.